So, what's on the show?
In just a few minutes, why Grand Canyon University's president thinks his school can work alongside the state's public universities.
We need to get more Arizonans into college. We need to keep more Arizonans here.
Also, is there an economic benefit to being bilingual and trying to strengthen the connection between old and young in the Navajo community? That's the show, and it's next on KJZZ after this news. Good Tuesday afternoon to you. I'm Mark Brody. It's the show on KJZZ. It might not look like it right now in parts of the valley, but there is still a 70% chance of rain throughout the afternoon with showers and thunderstorms likely and a high of 81. 50% chance of rain tonight, overnight lows in the mid-60s. Could see up to a half inch of rain tomorrow, still a 50% chance of showers and thunderstorms with a high of 79 tomorrow. It's 73 degrees right now. Residents in Navajo County in the northeastern part of the state were under a tornado warning this morning. Here in the valley, funnel clouds were reported near both Wickenburg and Anthem. Ken Waters with the National Weather Service says those are a rare event here in Arizona, known as cold air funnels.
In areas where we have a very high vertical wind shear, we can get occasions where we get these cold air funnel clouds, and that's what we're seeing today.
Waters says these clouds have been supported by today's unsettled atmosphere, which is also causing many of the pop-up thunderstorms. He says the funnel clouds are not considered a threat until they touch ground and become a tornado. An octogenarian who blocked a trail near Flagstaff right before a mountain bike race says he did it for the sake of owls. As KJZZ's Stina Sieg reports, J.D. Protiva appeared in federal court this week.
The 81-year-old is facing misdemeanor charges related to blocking the Eldon Springs Trail before an August downhill bike race. The Arizona Daily Sun reports Provida says the pass goes through protected Mexican spotted owl habitat. He's also charged with cutting trees and causing them to obstruct the trail. Provida talked about protecting owls back in 2007 when he pleaded guilty to stringing metal cables and moving debris across motorcycle trails in the San Francisco Peaks. In that case, he was given community service. Now, several members of the mountain biking community are calling for Provida to be banned from national forests entirely. Stina Sieg, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
You might be starting to receive ballots in the mail for next month's elections. Yes, there are elections in November, although you may have forgotten since they're not for president or any major state office. Instead, many of the ballot measures Arizonans will vote on will be asking for bonds or overrides to support schools. But they're not all created equal. KJZZ's Phil Latzman is here for an explanation.
Well, Mark, Arizonans will collectively vote on over $1 billion in school district bonds statewide on November 6th and in early voting leading up to it, and there's over $800 million up for grabs in Maricopa County alone. Sean McCarthy is senior research analyst with the Arizona Tax Research Association, which monitors these ballot initiatives in the state. Sean, what is at stake next month?
Well, it's interesting that at the same time that voters will be asked to weigh in on a heavy bond election collectively, $804 million in Maricopa County, which will be well over $1 billion with interest. At the same time that voters will be asked to weigh in on whether or not those are sound and prudent tax increases, you have policymakers down at the Capitol and the governor's Classrooms First Initiative Council debating whether or not bonds are a good way to finance capital. So it's a particularly interesting time because what a lot of education policy people understand is that bonds are a very inequitable source of financing.
Can you give us an example of that inequity as it exists in our school districts in the Valley?
Paradise Valley and Dysart. Those two school districts have roughly the same amount of pupils, but Paradise Valley's debt capacity is 265% larger because of the high taxable property value within Paradise Valley School District. And so, in essence, they can afford to ask their voters to approve a lot more debt, and you'll see it as an example this November as Paradise Valley Unified is asking its voters to approve about $227 million worth of bonds, whereas Dysart could never afford to ask for any, well, it certainly couldn't even ask for that much because it doesn't have the constitutional authority to because of the debt ceilings. But neither could their voters afford that because of the tax rates it would incur.
Wow. So with this inequity, you wonder, isn't there a better way to do this? Isn't there a better way to get funding for schools than relying on these individual districts to raise money in bond referendums?
Well, one of the ways is that you would make it the purview of the state, and the state could allocate money based on a per pupil basis for capital. You could make it, if there was money for the school facilities board, money could be put into there, and then schools could get capital funding based on adequacy needs.
The ATRA is not handing out specific recommendations on what to vote for and against, but what are some of the things that stick out in your mind as bond referendums that are on the ballot that may be asking for a bit much?
If you're in a particularly high property tax rate already, then bonds and overrides can be an enhanced burden on the property taxpayers of that area. And the perfect example of that, Phoenix Union is asking for $15 million a year additionally for a capital override. And it's probably the best example of an abuse of the taxpayers. This is a district that already is the highest spending high school district in the state. Although we haven't taken an official position on it, that one's a good one where we would say, voters, you should really think about your property tax rates and the economic disadvantage you put yourself at.
Sean McCarthy is Senior Research Analyst at the Arizona Tax Research Association. Sean, thanks very much for your time.
Oh, yeah, no problem. Thanks a lot.
That's KJZZ's Phil Latzman. Grand Canyon University's program to connect entrepreneurs with investors held its first pitch event last week. Students help vet the companies taking part in the Canyon Angels program. The university is also looking to grow its Phoenix campus, even after it announced earlier this month it would not go forward with plans for one in Mesa. For more on these and other topics, we welcome Brian Mueller, President and CEO of Grand Canyon University. And Brian, what led GCU to start Canyon Angels?
Well, it's kind of in our genetic code, so to speak. You know, we 6 years ago, when the university was $20 million in debt and we were about to close, we took a very innovative approach to not just saving the university, but also building it out by going to the public markets. And so Canyon Angels is another way that we support free enterprise capitalism, the use of the public markets, promoting the goodness of business and creating products and services that people around the world want to buy, creating jobs. That's been a big part of what we're trying to accomplish here on the West Side. So we're simply trying to pair entrepreneurs with investors, and we're getting our students involved by actually evaluating the businesses and giving their perspective on the potential for them to be successful.
Do you foresee at any point this could be a way to get student-led or faculty-led businesses up off the ground?
Well, we actually have another initiative along those lines. We have what we call a Lope Kingdom Fund, and that's kind of our own internal shark tank. And any student that comes forward with an idea that gets vetted through the process that we like and think has a chance to be successful, we fund those initiatives. The only qualifiers are that we want them to build the business in our West Side neighborhood and hire people in our West Side neighborhood.
What do you see as Grand Canyon University's role or place maybe in the scheme of higher education, both in Arizona and in the Valley more specifically?
Well, we're excited that the approach of using the public markets to get funding, access to capital, using that capital to build out what we're calling a hybrid university, which has both traditional students on our ground campus and also working adult students who want to attend online. But that hybrid campus model has produced tremendous efficiencies, which has allowed us to keep tuition very low. We've been able to freeze tuition for 8 years in a row. What we're trying to accomplish is to make really high quality private Christian higher education available to all social classes of Americans.
You mentioned that you've frozen tuition again this year, and that is obviously in contrast to the state universities, which, as I'm sure you know, have been having some financial issues with money coming from the state. Does that in some way help you that there's been all these headlines about the Board of Regents and the universities having to make cuts and losing money from the state and having to ask lawmakers for more money?
We don't think so. You know, we are big supporters of the state university system, and the Maricopa Community College system, and it's not a zero-sum game for us. It's not a slicing the pie thinner game for us. We think we need to get more Arizonans into college. We need to keep more Arizonans here. And then we also need to attract students from out of state that want to come and study here and then eventually stay here. And so, you know, Arizona doesn't have a history of lots of private education, which puts a lot of pressure on the state universities to educate all the in-state students who want to stay here. And so as Grand Canyon grows and scales and gets larger, we expect the whole thing just to get bigger. We used to lose thousands of kids that would leave Arizona and go to private universities outside the state. We're trying to keep those in the state, and then we're also attracting thousands of students right now from California.
With the build-out that you're working on your Phoenix campus, you also recently decided to forego plans to build a satellite campus in Mesa at Eastmark. Is that something that you think you might revisit at some point?
I think so. I don't know that it will be at Eastmark. It will probably be more of a commuter campus that will really focus on science, technology, engineering, and math programs. It's not slated for the next 2 years. We just can't stop the growth right now or keep up with the growth on our main campus. And because our tuition is low and because our room and board rates are low, the percentage of all students that want to live on campus is going up. And so we are getting a lot of East Valley students to come to Grand Canyon and live on our campus. And so we're serving their needs that way, although I think eventually there will be a need for some type of campus in the East Valley.
Brian Mueller is president and CEO of Grand Canyon University. Brian, thank you.
Thank you.
Still to come on the show, is there an economic advantage to being bilingual? That story and much more coming up. It's the show. Is there an advantage, economic or otherwise, to speaking more than one language? It's a question a new book tries to answer. Patricia Gondera is one of the editors of The Bilingual Advantage. She's also a research professor at UCLA and co-director of the Civil Rights Project there. Patricia, what were you trying to figure out with this research?
Evidence has been accumulating that bilingualism or speaking more than one language has tremendous benefits, and it's been accumulating in the areas of psychological benefits, social benefits, cognitive benefits. But none of these things seems to have been terribly convincing to policymakers who decide how it is we're educating our children. So it occurred to me, after having been doing this research for quite a long, long time, that maybe the area we needed to go to was the economic benefit.
And it looks like you found that in many ways there is no economic advantage to speaking more than one language.
Well, this is what's very interesting. And I tell people that the book is more like a detective story than it is like a series of studies, because that's where the whole thing begins, when we start looking at the research that has been done. And we find that over and over again, economists find that there is no economic benefit to being bilingual in the U.S.
Why do you think it is that there isn't a benefit to being bilingual?
Well, in fact, there is. In fact, what has happened is that over years, people have used census data as the way to look at this question. And the census is not really sensitive to the levels of bilingualism or biliteracy, it turns out, that people have. So when we pulled together groups of researchers actually from around the world who have been looking at the issue more carefully with more careful data about, well, just how bilingual are these folks, and are they biliterate? Are they really fully fluent in these languages? And are they younger people who are just now emerging into a global marketplace? Then the findings are completely different. And there we find that indeed there is an economic benefit, there's a labor market benefit, and there's an educational benefit.
As far as the labor benefit, is it just a matter of the more languages you speak, the more kinds of work you can do, which makes you more valuable and helps you maybe earn a higher salary?
No, it's not the more languages you speak. It's Certainly, there are key languages in the United States that are especially valuable. And in one of the studies that we do, we actually look at, you know, what languages do people want their employees to speak? You know, and it's not surprising. Spanish is the biggest and Chinese is the second. But actually, depending on where you are and what kind of work that you do, there are different languages that are especially important. For many employers, any additional language, they just feel that it's value added. The difference that we found really was more that a lot of people don't want to pay for this. So the bilingual or multilingual employee has an advantage in getting hired. But many times these individuals actually make more money in spite of not being paid more, because if they're in sales or they're doing commissions or these kinds of things, people in the public want to interact with people who speak their language. The big kind of bottom line to all of this for me was that for many years now, we've been moving from any kind of bilingual education to English-only instruction, with the idea that, you know, English is the goal and that the most important thing is that our kids get English. And to a large extent, it is. I mean, every child in the United States needs to speak English and speak it well. But this move towards English-only instruction, turns out that was a mistake. That was not where the big payoff is for individuals or for society. The big payoff for both is in maintaining the richness of these languages that our immigrant populations have brought with them, that's going to give us a leg up in the global economy.
Patricia Gandara is a research professor at UCLA and co-director of the Civil Rights Project there. She's also one of the editors of the new book, The Bilingual Advantage.
Generational differences are present in every culture, but the challenges are perhaps even more daunting in Native American communities. Earlier this year, Native Americans for Community Action, or NACA, received a $10,000 grant that's intended to connect youth more strongly with tribal elders. Marian Bitsui is the public education coordinator for NACA. Marian, how challenging is it to get youth closer to previous generations?
At NACA, I have the opportunity to work for the Circles of Care program, and we did a lot of data collection. There was a huge disconnect with the generations, and so we did some research on language preservation, and we had some focus groups. And we had the older population and the younger population. And there was, I guess you would call it, just a lack of a bridge to, you know, join them together. There was the older population who had all of this knowledge, all this wisdom, and they wanted to share it. However, they felt like there wasn't a lot of opportunity to share that with the younger generation. And then there's the younger generation who often felt like they wanted to learn that information. However, it was almost shameful that they didn't know their language, they didn't know their teachings, they didn't know their clans, things like that. And not only that, but often when they tried, they felt like they were scolded for not knowing.
Are we reaching a tipping point that as we move along, if in fact there isn't that bridge, there isn't that greater connection between the youth and the elders among Native Americans, that these are things that could be lost to the wind in some way? And this is one of the reasons why a grant like this at this time is so important.
Some of the teaching, some of the cultural aspects in our day-to-day lives that are slowly fading away. Our languages are, you know, we have people like Lorraine Manavi, who developed the Rosetta Stone with her team, and they're trying so hard to preserve what we have. And then you have the newer generation who wants to learn it, but they don't see the application in their day-to-day life. And that's something that we wanted to address, was how can we make these skills, how can we make these lessons applicable to a youth's life on a day-to-day basis? Because sometimes you can get in a framework where it's compartmentalized of, well, this is a ceremony and this happens at this time. And, you know, it doesn't become a part of your life. It doesn't become a part of who you are.
When it comes to the younger generations, are you dealing with this idea that they just don't really know about the traditions, or they are not attracted to the traditions? I mean, is it more about education, or is it more about attitude?
I think it's a little bit of both. You know, when you go into, like for my mother, for example, my mother had foster parents, and she grew up partially in dorms, in a dormitory. And she went to California, to Salinas, California, right outside of San Francisco, and was helped through college by her foster parents. She is very cultural. She's very traditional now, and she has always been. However, that's kind of the story for a lot of our parents, a lot of our aunts and our uncles, is that they were, in a sense, assimilated into a Western society, and they're learning algebra. They're learning, you know, things that are important to their careers, important to their professions. However, they're not learning so much about culture. And, you know, you have a generation that was taught that it's not okay to speak our language. It's not okay to be proud of being Native American. And then you have my generation, we're wanting that, we're craving that. We want to know, you know, for me, I personally want to learn my language, and I'm trying and I'm making efforts. And it's just, there's a lot of wants, there's a lot of understanding that it's important, and it's integral to who we are as a people.
Marian Bitsui of Native Americans for Community Action. She's been joining us from Flagstaff at KNEU. Marian, thanks so much.
Thank you.
I thought about the house I lived in growing up in my hometown. I thought about the pool I swim in after school.
Hopefully you got a chance to hear our Tiny Desert concert last week with Tyler Broderick of the band Diners. It's when we bring local bands into the KJZZ studios to play a couple of songs for us and talk a bit about their music. The video of Broderick's in-studio performance is now available on our website, kjzz.org/tinydesertconcert. There you can also check out video of other Tiny Desert concerts. And if you're in a band or know of one that you'd like to hear play a Tiny Desert concert, send us a note, theshow@kjzz.org. And still to come on the show, downtown Phoenix's efforts to try to land a grocery store. Those stories, that story, and much more, still to come. It's the show.
Earlier this month, California became the fifth state in the nation to legalize physician-assisted suicide for residents who are terminally ill. There doesn't seem to be momentum at Arizona's capital to move forward with similar legislation, but the Maricopa County Medical Society, a physician advocacy organization, decided to survey its doctors and find out what they thought. Jay Conyers is CEO of the Medical Society. Jay, what questions were in the survey?
One was whether or not they agreed that physicians should have a legal authority to prescribe lethal doses of drugs to assist terminally ill patients with ending life. And the second question was whether or not they felt that Arizona should consider similar legislation. We then added a comment section because we figured this would be a provocative series of questions, and we felt there would be a lot of value in what we could see, you know, they actually had to say about this.
How many people did you get responses from, and how did the numbers line up?
We got a very good response rate from our physicians. First, take in mind that these are physicians that work during the day. So we announced to them that we'd be closing the polls within about 24 hours. We got a little over 100 responses, which was a very good response rate compared to similar surveys that we've run recently. We knew going into this that the general public support for assisted suicide nationwide was anywhere between about 64% and 70%. So we were anticipating a similar response rate for our physicians. Mm-hmm. Of those that responded, it looks like exactly 2/3 were in support or agreed that Arizona should not only pass similar legislation, but that physicians should have that legal authority to prescribe lethal doses.
You mentioned the comments section. Any comments you can share with us anonymously?
Sure, absolutely. You know, by and large, those physicians that were supportive of such legislation did so with caution, and we anticipated that. Some of the cautious comments that we got was, yes, it's a good idea, but only if there is a safeguard to protect those vulnerable patients that may otherwise be taken advantage of. And another comment was that it would be important to have sort of a regulatory process in place whereby someone just can't walk in and say, I wish to die. So with that in mind, there was a suggestion that a multidisciplinary approach be put in place to where the family, primary care, mental health, and everything else is taken into consideration, which is exactly what those states that have legalized this do.
Hippocratic Oath often comes up. one phrase that often comes to mind is first do no harm is what I think about. Now, for people, that can mean different things. That can mean maintaining life is doing no harm. For others, it's, well, if you keep someone suffering, that is actually doing more harm. Is that something that the doctors have to think about when they're thinking about this sort of thing?
Absolutely, Steve. I'm glad you asked that. In fact, we had a number of physicians that pointed to that as the reason why they supported it, because they felt that allowing or not allowing patients another way to die other than just waiting for death to be on their doorsteps was a violation of the Hippocratic Oath. Mm-hmm. But not surprisingly, we had quite a few physicians that felt, first and foremost, that doing so, assisting in suicide, was a clear violation of the Hippocratic Oath. Mm-hmm. You know, interestingly, two of the other opposing comments that we got from a number of physicians dealt with one feeling that doing so was tantamount to murder. So that tells us that this is a pretty sensitive topic that, you know, if we were to consider such here in Arizona, it would probably come with both, you know, strong support as well as strong opposition. The last thing, it was something that we did not anticipate, and that was in order to consider something like this, you would need to weigh the influence of the insurance companies, because covering something like this, in other words, a single dose of a lethal drug, would pale in comparison from a cost standpoint as opposed to a long, lengthy cancer treatment regimen.
Is there a feeling that there is momentum, not necessarily to have more states do this, but more momentum to really discuss the pros and cons of the issues very openly?
I think so, and I'm not speaking on behalf of my organization, but, you know, looking at the genesis of the Death with Dignity Act that I think was initiated in Oregon in 1997, you know, there's almost 20 years of data now, and there's no data that points to the system leading to people being taken advantage of. I don't think it's an overwhelming number of patients that have jumped to utilize the system, and so there really is no support that someone could point to that says this is a bad idea, at least from a data standpoint.
Jay Conyers is CEO of the Maricopa County Medical Society.
Downtown Phoenix has seen a lot of development over the past few years, but the area still does not have a grocery store. Will that change? To find out, we turn to Dan Klocke, Vice President of Development for Downtown Phoenix, Inc., an umbrella organization of groups focused on improving downtown. And Dan, on the list of concerns you hear from Downtown Phoenix residents, where does the lack of grocery stores fall?
Number one, there's no question. People have been asking about that for a long time. For many, many years, and I've worked there for 12 years, number one had been a drugstore, which we got a few years back in Cityscape, and it's done incredibly well. But number two, and now number one, is a grocery store. And so that is top of the list and something that we're thinking about all the time.
This has been going on, as you say, for so long. Why isn't there a grocery store downtown?
Well, I think a couple things. One, Arizona isn't the most urban place in the world. And so to do an urban grocery store, you need a company that clearly understands how to make them work. An urban grocery store is going to be on a smaller footprint. It's going to have issues with parking. You're not going to have surface parking. It'll be structured parking. You're going to have a smaller footprint, and so you'd have a different mix of product inside. And so our local grocers don't have that as a model locally that they can sort of copy. Now, luckily, some of them do have presence in other states like California. So there is at least some knowledge within the corporations of how to do this. But it's harder. There's no question.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the grocery stores that have stores in Arizona also have maybe other named stores in places like California, other big cities. It seems like it wouldn't be that big of a challenge to come up with a slightly smaller footprint based on something maybe they have in L.A. or San Diego or, you know, San Francisco, a place like that.
Yeah, I think that's eventually what we're going to see. At this point, I don't think it's a question of if, it's more when, because when you look at the demographics of downtown and the numbers of people living there and working there, it just makes sense to have a grocery store. When you look at the numbers, there's about 8,000 to 9,000 people living in downtown. And when I say downtown, I'm talking about south of McDowell to Lincoln and 7th Avenue to 7th Street. So it's about 1.7 square miles, very small market area as grocery stores go, but lots and lots of people.
Do you have a sense of where this grocery store might end up? I mean, is there in your mind sort of a natural location for it to be downtown?
You know, I think you're looking at roughly Jefferson Street to Roosevelt, somewhere within that area. Obviously, that's a fairly sizable area, but that's where the bulk of your residents are living. That's where the bulk of your employees are. So it makes most sense to be somewhere within that area.
As downtown becomes more popular and more people live there, prices go up. Is there a point at which it will become not possible for a grocer to have space in there and still make a profit and be successful?
I think any developer will use a grocery store more as part of the amenity package in some way. Not that it's going to be free space or anything like that. Grocers typically don't pay that much per square foot for their grocery store, and I don't think that will be much different in downtown. But I think what it would do is give a significant leg up to any developer who's obviously building above that grocery store for residential or office or whatever, to be able to essentially subsidize the grocery store rent by having that other product above it.
So do you anticipate it being sort of a ground level thing with some other use on top?
I would expect that, unless there was some site that made sense where it was just a freestanding grocery store and just parking above it. But from a numbers perspective, I think it makes more and more sense to have a significant amount of building above it as well.
Once there is a grocery store downtown, does that make your job easier to sell downtown and really tell people, hey, look, you really don't have to leave this area. You now have everything you need in this one area.
You know, clearly it's an important part of any neighborhood. But I think what's most important right now is that downtown has become a neighborhood. In the past, we've looked at, well, we've built this project or this stadium or this thing or that thing, and people come in to go to that specific use. Now we have all these things together and have truly created a neighborhood. So sort of the completion of that neighborhood would be a grocery store, I think, in a lot of ways.
Dan Klonke is Vice President for Development at Downtown Phoenix, Inc. Dan, thank you.
You're welcome.
It's almost time for the next episode of The Quiz Show. That's when we bring back our resident quiz master and Jeopardy! Tournament of Champions winner, Leszek Pawlowicz. He'll face off against a KJZZ staff member in a game of trivia, but you can get in on the action too. Just solve this puzzle. What occurs once in a minute, twice in a moment, and never in a thousand years? When you have the answer, email us at theshow@kjzz.org. We'll randomly draw two names from the correct answers, and either Leszek or one of our KJZZ newsroom staffers will play on your behalf. If your player wins, you'll win a special KJZZ item. We head now to another Valley Hot Corner, spots with a lot going on. But first, as always, let's meet our tour guide.
I'm Kimber Lanning, and I'm the Executive Director of Local First Arizona.
And we are sitting inside today because it's very hot outside. Where are we?
Peixote Coffee in downtown Chandler.
Specifically, we're on Arizona Avenue, south of Chandler Boulevard, less than a block from Chandler City Hall, sitting on a couch inside what Peixote calls its coffee lounge.
Downtown Chandler is super vibrant. The business community, they have a downtown alliance, and they just put in a stage. So they're going to be using a shared stage to do all sorts of events. It's launching with Oktoberfest. You've got Santan Brewing down here doing special Oktoberfest beers. This is a fabulous area with a great amount of diversity. So you've got fantastic restaurants. There's great shopping. There's a lot of offices nearby that makes it walkable and vibrant. You've got art galleries. You've got performing arts, all of it right here in the city center.
How important is it to have, as you say, some of the art stuff here? So it's not just people coming to eat or, you know, have a drink after work, but there are other types of things to draw people here.
You know, one of the things that I think that downtown Chandler really gets right is the diversity of things to do. So they have kids events, they have gallery receptions, they have all sorts of performance. When they have music on the stage, it's going to be a wide array, something for everyone down here. And, you know, you've got right over here, you've got a glass shop where it's incredibly creative with artisans from around the world being shown here. Right in the next plaza over, you've got Sibley's West, which carries over 100 Arizona artisans. And so, like I said, you've got a wide variety of things that are happening here, entertainment, something for everyone.
For how long would you say this area has been kind of a bustling part of town?
for quite some time. I mean, if you imagine all the way back, you've got the San Marcos Hotel, which is turn of the century, beautiful, historic hotel, and they've got a brand new restaurant, again becoming vibrant and adding to the street. They've got Crust Italian restaurant, which just opened up. So this area was incredibly vibrant, and then, like most city centers, it died off for a while, and it has become vibrant again over the last 10, 12 years.
What do you think helped start that?
Well, I think there's a real change occurring in people's choice for a lifestyle. People want walkable downtown centers. They want to have the ability to park in one place and experience a lot of unique independent businesses. People like these unique buildings. They're butted up against each other, independent businesses that you can't find anywhere else, and it makes a destination, and you're willing to drive for it.
Who do you find in this area? I mean, are there people who live near here who can walk here? Or do people tend to have to drive here and then walk around once they get here?
I think it's definitely a combination of both. Some people are going to be walking. There's great apartments and condominiums right near here. Again, some people walk over during their lunch break or right after work for happy hour. However, downtown Chandler is enough of a destination that plenty of people drive here as well.
When you look at downtown parts of Valley Cities, is it pretty common to have city offices right in that area as well? I mean, what role do those play in sort of the development of the other stuff around them?
It is so important to have office space in the downtown core nearby, because the workers in those companies that are located nearby are critically important to the success and the vibrancy of the downtown center. So whether you're talking about stopping from meetings on your way into work, of course the mad dash during the lunch hour, or the directly after work, the meeting for a drink during the happy hour, all of those are very, very important to the success of the downtown area.
It looks as though what the city is calling downtown is a fairly compact area. It's not like miles and miles and miles of street and sidewalk and shops and stuff. Does that make it easier to maintain and to market when it's sort of a compact area and you're not over such a big stretch of space?
Sure. In the technology community, they call it clustering. And anytime you can cluster a bunch of like-minded, independently owned businesses, it's going to be successful for everyone, because then they can pool their resources that they have here with downtown Chandler, pool their resources to market themselves as a destination. They can tend to come together more around events and those kinds of things. It's easier to communicate and have a shared vision for that area. So anytime you can cluster businesses together, it's going to be more successful.
Kimber Lanning is the executive director of Local First Arizona. We met at Peixoto Coffee on Arizona Avenue in downtown Chandler. There's a new form of dancer-size sweeping the valley that's guaranteed to leave you hanging. As KJZZ's Phil Latzman found out, the art of aerial dance isn't for everyone, but studios around the valley are making it available to anyone, and you don't even have to run away and join the circus.
Picture this, a room full of people, mostly women, grasping long sheets of fabric hanging 12 feet above the floor. They're clambering up the fabric and then rappelling downward with cat-like ease, the way star athletes would in a high school gym.
So this actually used to be an old cheer and tumble gym, so it's great. It's hard to find good ceilings in Phoenix for this type of stuff.
Monique Dorsey and her husband Jeff run Vertical Fix in Tempe, which offers this unique form of exercise.
As you can see, these two girls are climbing what we call an aerial rope or a cord lease. And they are climbing to the top because it's a great conditioning.
What we're watching is part art, part dance, and a lot of ouch. But no pain, no gain, right?
What does it take to be a good aerialist?
A lot of dedication, high tolerance to pain, a little bit of and a lot of bravery to be up in the air like that.
Dorsey says aerial dance is catching on because of its ability to combine dance, art, and exercise. It's been featured as a top fitness trend for 2015 by AOL, Men's Fitness, Health.com, and even featured on the Today Show. Aerial yoga has even caught on, where many of the yoga poses are done hanging from a hammock or silk. And if it seems like I'm describing a circus act, you're partially right. Its popularity can also be linked to shows like Cirque du Soleil and other high-flying acts.
So when somebody says they want to run away and join the circus,
you can
help them out.
Absolutely, yes. We're actually one of our performers. We are helping her get ready to start auditioning.
24-year-old Caitlin McMaster is one of the daring students.
I am not training to be in the circus. I'm just doing it for me. But I do think it's catching on because even when I started coming here just a couple months ago, the studio has exploded since then, it feels like.
But it's certainly not with the greatest of ease. Thomas Park is an experienced hiker and climber, and even he has trouble getting a handle on those long silks that extend from the ceiling.
The hardest thing is grip strength. And so I came from a rock climbing background. I had climbed for 12 years, and so I had really good grip strength. And even with that, silks were still really, really hard.
I can personally attest to that as I made my futile attempt to bravely scale the silks, yet barely got off the ground.
Now, scoop and lock. Scoop.
How was that?
Good, so get your foot, okay. Now I need you to come down safely. So.
Well, I made it like 6 feet that time.
Yes, because you had it in your arms.
How do you guys do that?
I had it in my arms. And here's a hint when it comes to aerial dance. It's all in the legs and feet. That is if you can figure out how to wrap those legs and feet around the silks and begin your upward climb. And then, yeah, good luck getting down. So be warned, it's not for everyone. But for those seeking a challenging high-flying workout or maybe even planning on a career in the circus, this is for you. In Tempe, Phil Latzman, KJZZ News.